Hi, this is Sean Romano. This is the first episode in an 8-part series on LASIK. I'm calling it Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About LASIK, probably. I sat down with Hunter Vision founder and refractive surgeon Joel Hunter, MD, to shine a light on the topic of LASIK and laser eye surgery. In this episode, Dr. Hunter and I get into the finer details of how the eye works. We discuss the nuances of optic nerves and how Bob Ross may have something to do with the general public's unusual knowledge of rods and cones. This is the first of a stack of conversations about, well, we're calling this Everything You Ever Want to Know About LASIK. So whether or not that will stick or if it's actually true, hopefully it will be true by the end.
Yes, everything that you wanted to know. Yeah. If not, if that's not catchy enough, then we'll end up changing it to something else. But for now, everything that you wanted to know about LASIK. So you and I sat down and kind of went through from beginning to end, you know, what would be important to know about LASIK and who needs it and how it works. And so we realized the very first part that you have to establish kind of the base of the pyramid, you know, your foundational support would be just how the eye works. And so that's today. Today is about how the eye works, the human eye, which is a lot like a lot of animal eyes, a lot of similarities there. Not as much like crustaceans' eyes, but once you get into mammalia, really similar eyeballs. So the eye works. It's like, have you ever heard what they say? You know, the eye works like a camera.
I have heard this.
Yeah,
I've heard it several times.
It's accurate. It's accurate. It's one of those things that sounds like it's an oversimplification, which it kind of is, but really, really accurate in broad brushstrokes, because a camera works by taking light information coming into this lens, and it gets focused by a lens onto a layer of film, or with digital camera or an iPhone, a digital sensor. And that's it, front to back. You know, you have a lens that focuses these rays of light onto a sensor or onto a piece of film. And the eye is exactly like that, in that you have a lens. Specifically, you have two lenses inside each eyeball. Well, technically, you have two lenses, one on and one inside each eyeball. And it focuses light onto the analog of what would be the film, which is the retina. And that's the whole thing, start to finish. It's interesting, because I had the wrong conception of it for a couple of decades. I thought about this stuff a lot, you know, middle school, high school. Other kids played football, and I thought about this. But the misconception that I had for a really long time was that light's getting focused into a point source, you know, the type of point source, you know, if you use a magnifying glass and you're trying to burn an ant, you know.
Well, that's what I thought, how it works.
And really the way it works is much more that you have a certain focal plane, a certain area where things are going to be the most focused on the other side of the lens. And so in that way, it's a lot like when you are shining an image from a projector onto a screen, you can turn that little ring around the outside of that lens and watch it go in and out of focus. That's a lot how the lenses focus onto the retina. Really, when you look at a big tall oak tree and you have it in the center of your vision, inside your eye, what's actually happening is the light from that oak tree is coming in, going through those two lenses and getting focused into a tiny little postage stamp sized oak tree.
But it's smaller than a postage stamp, right? How big is it?
The whole macula, where all of your vision, that's anything better than about 20/70. And 20/70 is legal driving vision, which is scary.
Wow.
But that whole macula from side to side, the diameter of the area of your retina that does all the good vision, is about a millimeter and a half or so, you know. You could say 2 millimeters if you were being generous.
That's very small.
Yeah, it's tiny. Yeah, so like a small postage stamp. A tiny postage stamp, yeah. Because eyes are... you know, there it's a globe, and so, you know, from front to back, the whole eyeball average, it's about an inch. You know, an average eyeball is 23.5 millimeters, and so this retina lines the whole back half of that sphere, and with some sort of complicated mathematics, we could come up with the surface area that it is on average, and I'm going to say 11 parsecs. I'm not actually sure exactly.
That's a measurement?
No, it's a measurement of astronomical distances.
So it's not used for the eye?
No.
Oh,
no.
But you use astronomical measurements in your daily life?
No, it's just that was what Han Solo said, that the Millennium Falcon made made a trip in something in parsecs. Oh,
showing my ignorance right now. Since I didn't get that joke.
But anyway, so it gets focused into a tiny little image onto the retina. And then from that point, your retina, which is just a layer of nerve tissue, technically it's 10 layers of nerve tissue that are lined up in a really, really complicated and specific inside to outside, middle of the eye to back of the eye, layering, like a very complicated tiramisu. They, all of those layers interact with each other and do some fine tuning. Okay, so the retina, so the retina's got these layers. There's 10 layers from inside to outside. That's how they're categorized. They have names like the inner plexiform layer and the outer plexiform layer as you get farther and farther towards the wall.
There's 15, you said?
10.
And you've memorized all the names of all the layers?
Yeah, I had to know them at one point. I wonder if I still know them. We'll have to cut this out. But yeah, so it's the very first thing you hit is the internal limiting membrane, and then the retinal nerve fiber layer, and then the outer nuclear layer, the outer plexiform layer, the inner nuclear layer, the inner plexiform layer, there's the ganglion cell layer, retinal pigment epithelium, and Bruch's membrane. But I know I'm leaving one out. The photosensory layer, which is where all your rods and cones are.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, that's an important one. I left that one out.
Man.
So that's a throwback.
It's incredibly impressive.
Thanks.
If you remember that.
At one point in my life depended on knowing that, because when you take those oral boards,
it's intense. They're oral.
Yeah, because you have the written boards, which are the hard one. That's the hard test.
Multiple choice.
It is. That's the thing. It's multiple choice. It's just like 7 hours long, and every question is just insanely. It was really something. But oral boards, you just have to. It's easier questions, but you are sitting with an expert in X, Y, or
Z. And they're waiting for you to screw up, right?
Yeah, and they ask you a question, they just stare at you. And so you have to know kind of everything just enough that you don't make an idiot of yourself. But if you have the retina guy, he might just be like, what layer would I find just on top of the outer nuclear layer? And then you have to be like, that's a good question. I was just thinking about that.
cold sweat.
Yeah. So anyway, the image gets focused onto the retina, which has these 10 layers to it. The most important, even though they all kind of depend on each other, the one that gets the most highlighted because it's where the action really first happens is this photosensory layer, which is the famous rods and cones. I'm not really sure why rods and cones have entered into normal vernacular quite as much as they have, because it's a pretty subspecialized.
I have a theory about that. It's a distant memory, and I don't know if it was like a parody, if it was actually a real thing, but there was somewhere I thought I saw a Bob Ross painting rods and cones. Huh. And I don't know if it was like a kid's show that appropriated
Bob
Ross's approach and he's kind of parodying it, or if it was actually Bob Ross like taking the time to talk about how you see color. But now maybe I need to look it up and find out. Maybe we could put it in show notes.
Now that I think about it, I think maybe you sent me that.
I don't know. I don't remember. To tell you the truth, I mean, Bob Ross, he's been on Netflix for the last few months, and I dive in every once in a while to just mellow out. It's pretty
me too.
Awesome.
I have not made it longer than 45 minutes. I've never made it long without just being like... So it's a chill out with Bob Ross.
Yeah. And that's the one.
It is awesome. So anyway, the photosensory layer of rods and cones is what takes this, and it deserves to be famous because it's amazing what it does. It takes this energy that is purely in the electromagnetic spectrum. It is just...
You're speaking about light.
Light.
Okay.
It is just light. And so the electromagnetic spectrum is... wiggling photons, or it's speeding photons or wiggling waveforms or the duality of both of them. But it's everything from gamma rays that turned, Dr. what was his name that turned into the Hulk?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not good with my superheroes.
Bruce Jenner. what was his name? It's going to drive me crazy.
Mark Ruffalo. That's.
But anyway, it's extremely, extremely high energy, short wavelength.
This is the spectrum X-rays are on, correct?
Yeah. I mean, and
that's, so light is on that same spectrum.
X-rays are a lot longer than that. Yeah. Okay. So if you look at the electromagnetic spectrum, it is all energy that is photons traveling, and the more tightly compressed mm-hmm. the wavelength is, the higher the frequency, the higher the energy that light is, and so it goes all the way to the extreme end, which is gamma radiation,
which isn't good.
Bad. Yeah. That's how we got the Incredible Hulk. Who ended up using his powers for good, but gamma radiation, which is inside the sun, it's this extremely high energy radiation, and then as you go longer wavelengths down the electromagnetic spectrum, you get to X-rays and you get to microwaves, and then wow. It's not until you get to this wavelength of between 700 nanometers and 400 nanometers that now you've entered into the same energy, but at that wavelength is everything from red through violet, red, mm-hmm. orange, yellow, blue, green, indigo, violet.
And violet being the shorter wavelength light?
Exactly.
And red being longer? Okay.
Exactly. So pure violet light really falls somewhere around 400, 395 nanometers. Really, deep red, but not quite infrared, which is a little bit longer and invisible again because it's a little bit too long of a wavelength for us to see, falls more towards, 650, 700, that end of the wavelength. And then if you keep getting, longer and longer wavelengths mm-hmm. of light, now you've moved into infrared, and then you get into, FM and AM.
Oh my gosh. I was just about to say, is radio on that?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And
wow.
So, constantly around us all the time is, this electromagnetic spectrum. The light that we can't see through walls is, it's just common knowledge. You can't, see through a wall because that's the electromagnetic spectrum that we can see. But anyone who's listened to a radio inside of a room, has
right.
demonstrated that electromagnetic, if you make
it
the
passes
light
through,
yeah, the wavelength long enough gives more penetration through stuff. It's the same reason that you lose AM radio through a tunnel, but you don't lose FM radio through a tunnel. It's the length of the wavelength.
Oh my gosh, my mind's
so anyway, blown. What the photoreceptors do is they take this energy between 400 and 700 nanometers in the electromagnetic spectrum, and they turn it into a nerve impulse because that light mm-hmm. hits these photoreceptors, and it causes this conformational change in a molecule, this rhodopsin molecule, and that change causes that nerve to fire.
So it's like a switch, like a molecular switch.
It is, yeah. Okay. It's a molecular switch, and it's the same type of thing that happens when light hits plant leaves and chlorophyll. There's a switch that gets hit by the photon that starts off this chain reaction. In this case, what happens is it hits the switch and it causes this hyperpolarization of these nerve cells, and then ganglion cells send their signal down this nerve fiber. All of those ganglion cells have a single nerve fiber leaving them, and every one of those nerve fibers mm-hmm. gathers together into this superhighway that is the optic nerve. And
okay.
the average eye, there's about 1.2 million ganglion cells.
So the optic nerve is that big nerve in the back of your eye that kind of feeds off the eye?
Exactly, okay. Yep. And so if you did a cross-sectional view of an optic nerve, it's 1.2 million little nerve fibers.
Wow.
And, some blood vessels also. And it's why it's really hard to fix.
Sounds
impossible
like
to fix an optic nerve because you have to reconnect 1.2 million little nerve fibers. Otherwise, everyone's upside down or something. No, that's never been done. But as you look at an optic nerve, it's this superhighway of all these nerves. But what's interesting is at that point, all that you have is this binocular. You have 1.2 million coming from each eye.
Right.
Light transmission system that's turned this electrical energy into chemical energy and electrical all the way down the path. But that's not the image that we see. We don't, you know, there's post-processing that goes on that is responsible for the enormous majority of how we see things. The reason that optical illusions can work and the reason that we can see differently under different conditions and the, there's so much about the way we see that is entirely because our visual cortex, which is way back in the very back of our brain, it's this, it's hanging off this lobe that's all the way back on it. When you lay your head on a pillow, that's the part of your skull that's touching that occipital lobe, which has your visual cortex.
Is that where the optic nerve connects to the visual cortex? Or
it's even more complicated than that, because the optic nerves cross over at this optic chiasm that happens just behind your nose at the top of your nasal passages, and that optic chiasm, all of the optic nerve fibers that were on the left side of your vision. For your left eye, they all stay on the left. But all the nerve fibers that were on the left side of your vision for the right eye, they cross over to the left and they join over there. So that's on the left side of your world is coming in. By the time you get past the optic chiasm, which is where everything crosses over, all of the light information coming in from the left side of the world is only on the left side of your brain. And on the right eye, the same thing. So everything that's light that hit on the right side of the right eye stays on the right side, doesn't cross over. Everything on the right side of the left eye crosses over.
Oh, weird. So it's divide, the eye is bifurcated, divided, and then those two. Wow.
And so from that point on, at any point past that place, if you were to go in and, you know, surgically cut that optic, it's called the optic tract after that. If you were to surgically cut that, what would happen to that person is he would be completely blind from the middle over on the right eye to the right side, and from the middle over on the left eye to the right side. But he'd have perfect vision on the left side of both eyes. and it's one of the ways that they can you can diagnose where strokes are. You know, if somebody has a if somebody has a visual defect where they can't see anything that's up and out in each eye, you know, so they, so in their right eye, they can't see up into the right. In their left eye, they can't see up into the right.
Then
you can localize their stroke to their temporal lobe in their left side, you know, because that's that's Myers loop and it knocked it. That's a board's question. Pie in the sky defect is what that's called. But it all ends up back in your, you know, visual cortex. Now, what leaves your eye in each eye is 1.2 million nerves. But by the time it gets to your visual cortex, that same light information has been so processed, so amped up or decreased down, dampened down, and that your optic lobe with its visual cortex, the nerve cells responsible for processing those 1.2 million nerve fibers for each eye, it's in the billions. And because there's a lot more that goes into the processing of that image than just how the light hit the retina. And so as you get farther and farther back towards the tip of your visual cortex, it's more and more detailed vision. So the two ways that you can lose your really fine detail central vision is get a hole in the middle of your macula in your retina, or get a lesion on the very, very, very tip of your optic lobe where your, where the tip of your visual cortex is. Both of those people will have a very central visual defect.
So when you say lesion, like for instance, my mother has multiple sclerosis. Would that be a way to create a lesion?
Luckily, and I guess it's hard to say luckily about too much with multiple sclerosis, but because multiple sclerosis mostly actually entirely affects, you know, these white matter tracts, it's really rare for it to have, you know, any implications for a specific area of gray matter, which is what all that processing stuff back there would be.
Got it.
It affects the highways a lot more than the cities, I guess you could say.
Okay.
And so I just made that up, actually.
Yeah.
I like that, though.
That's good. Yeah. It's really good.
So try to find ways to bring that up in conversations. Be like, what do you guys think of multiple sclerosis? You know what I think. So anyway, that's the visual system. And it is so much more complicated than that, that not only would it take a long time to talk about, we couldn't even get to the end of what – we'd get to the end of what I know, you know, after a little while. And then we'd have years more to talk about what visual and, you know, neuro ophthalmologists know about this stuff. And then – you get to that same point you do always with the brain where, you know, the brain's so complicated it can't understand itself, that, you know. and so that's kind of how the eye works and how vision works in general. You have, you know, a oak tree that you're looking at, that oak tree gets focused into a tiny oak tree on your macula.
And
all of this processing happens.
It's upside down though, right? I've heard it's upside down.
That's true. Okay. It's not, yeah, upside down and reversed. Yeah.
Okay.
Which is why, and you know, you don't want to go nuts with this, but if you take your finger and you rub at the bottom of your eye, the area where you see that little star moving around is at the top of your eye. Everything's.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So it's all upside down and reversed.
Oh.
So that is, that's the story.
Wow. That was quite an adventure.
Here on 101 The Eyes.
So you mentioned that when you talk about how the eye works, it's much more about what we do focuses a lot on cornea, which is one of the lenses. So
yeah.
Can you talk about kind of from the retina sort of forward in the eye and sort of what's happening there?
Yeah. And what's nice about having that context of how, you know, how vision actually works and how the eye actually works is even though this idea of you're trying to fix vision on a cornea and using lasers and all this stuff, it's really hard to find anywhere where you can simplify things more than just how is light getting focused in the front of the eye. You know, it's the simplest place that you can find to affect the vision one way or the other, because all of that focusing stuff is what determines everything after that. You know, mm-hmm. because you can have the most profoundly brilliant visual cortex possible. If light's just hitting that retina as a blurry mess, there's nothing there to process.
Right.
It's just greens and blues and
yellows.
It's
kind of like when you, someone sends you a really like low res photo and like, hey, can you blow this up into a poster? And you're like, well, I can't really add any pixels to it. It kind of still looks blurry.
It's a lot like that. You know, when you're trying to correct your vision, you're trying to get a really highly detailed 4K image onto your retina. Technically, it doesn't work like that, but it's the same idea. You know, there's a lot more light information to work with. The way the cornea works is it's this domed shape. You know, if you've ever seen a soft or hard contact lens for that matter, mm-hmm. there's this dome shape to it. It's domed like that because it has to fit exactly the way that the cornea is shaped.
And so the cornea is the very outer part, clear part of your eye that's over the center of your eye.
Yeah. Okay. And it looks, if you take it off of an eye, you know, if you're doing a corneal transplant or, you know, harvesting a cornea or putting a cornea on somebody that needs it for a transplantation, a cornea by itself, it looks a lot like a soft contact lens. I mean, it's thicker, but because it's a whopping half of a millimeter thick, but it's that same domed clear shape. It's a bowl. Mm-hmm. And the way that it works is any convex lens, the property of that is that as light travels through it, it will be condensed. It will, mm-hmm. It will be shrunk down and minified. And so your cornea is the first place where light gets focused, and 2/3 of the focusing happens there. All of that focusing power is measured in a unit called diopters, the same way that distance is measured in inches and miles, or centimeters and meters if you're anywhere else in the world, but here in Liberia.
Sorry, world, we haven't caught up yet.
Yeah. Did you hear about in the South when they tried to go to the metric system and people actually shot signs down that said kilometers per hour?
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
The metric system is such an elegant solution.
Really,
I don't know why we don't just get over
it's
ourselves.
Really funny. It's not there yet. But anyway, that being said, I have no idea how fast I'm going if it's in kilometers an hour. So the unit of measurement for focusing is diopters. And so your cornea is the first lens, and it's the most powerful one. That unit of measurement is called diopters. And diopters are how much is this light getting focused, basically. There's a formula for it, but you measure how much focusing is happening in diopters. Your cornea, on average, it does somewhere in the range of 40-ish diopters.
So is that the number? Is a diopter the number on my prescription?
It is, because it's how much it's focusing. And so cornea is 40-ish diopters. And the lens inside the eye, you know, arguably the more famous lens, stealing the name lens, you know. So
if
you had cornea, that was all that was left over. Lame name.
Man.
I had to figure out something else. But the lens inside the eye, the crystalline lens, it averages, you know, 20-ish diopters, you know. So it's kind of it's a 2/3, 1/3 mm-hmm. split in how much light's getting focused. The cornea, because it's such a powerful focusing lens, really, really small differences in corneal curvature make a really big difference in how clearly somebody sees.
Mm-hmm.
And so people can have corneas that are too flat or too steep, but there's really two main factors for most people. There's a lot of others, but there's two main factors for most people in how clear they see. It's how steep is that cornea and how far away is the macula that it's focusing on? How long is that eyeball?
Okay.
Every millimeter longer that an eyeball is, that prescription is going to be another minus three. You know, so if their eye should have been 23 and a half, but it's 24 and a half, minus three. If it's 25 and a half, now they're in minus six glasses.
Wow.
And so there's a lot of, I mean, that really, really small area, there's very, very minute differences that make huge differences in the vision. But it's really simple to fix that on the cornea because if you change the curvature just a little bit, you can make a big difference.
Right.
It did not make it very far through research trials, but they were like, can we change the length of the eye at all to see if that'll help things? Definitively not at this point. It does not work. So
that sounds like a massive undertaking.
Yeah. But there's just so much focusing power there that you can really take advantage of that to fix vision, you know, when you're talking about LASIK, which is what we'll be talking about, you know, in future talks that we're having. Your prescription on your glasses, if it's massive, you know, I'm a minus eight, I'm a minus 10, you know, I mean, just, mm-hmm. you know, those kind of 1 in 100 type of prescriptions, that's in diopters, you know, that eye in a minus eight is missing, or they are, a minus eight has eight diopters too much mm-hmm. focusing power. They have to subtract off those eight diopters. So they put on glasses that have minus eight mm-hmm. and now they're good. Well, your cornea, you know, that person's cornea might be 45 diopters of power, you know, so getting rid of eight mm-hmm. diopters of power there is not, you know, you're not even getting into where you're hitting majority levels, you know, it's really
right.
minute changes.
Just a tiny little bit, yeah.
So that's what the cornea does. It's this layer of clear tissue that focuses light. It's basically a biological clear lens, which is really amazing because the collagen that it's made out of is the same collagen that you have in your skin and on the white of your eye. Mm-hmm. It's just spaced perfectly evenly in a perfect pattern so that light can be transmitted through it, you know, like through a gateway. And that's why we can see through it. But the collagen molecules themselves are the same.
Wow. It's like a whole universe, man.
Yeah.
Right in your eyeball.
But if you were to change the conformation and then the relationship of the layers of collagen or how spaced apart they are from each other, that cornea becomes opaque. And we know that because in medicine, if somebody gets a really, really, really swollen cornea, a gross example would be every time they show a dead person on TV and they've got if you're watching The Walking Dead,
right?
And everybody's got white, gray eyes. Medically, that's accurate, you know, because if your cornea gets thick and swollen, those collagen fibers get more spaced apart and it's gray and white. Hmm. Even if you take something like the clear plastic that's on a loaf of bread,
yep.
If you were to take that in your hands and have it clear and then stretch it out, you'll find that as you stretch it, it becomes opaque.
Yeah.
You've changed the nature of those fibers to each other. That's not collagen.
Right. I was going to say, but
even with different, you know, propylenes and things like that, as you stretch out those molecules, that changes how clear, how transparent it is because it changes how much light can travel through.
So this is why you decided to focus on cornea, I'm assuming. I mean, you're essentially a cornea surgeon.
Yeah, that's...
And
yeah.
So all of your knowledge is focused on that one.
Cornea and bread packaging are my two... That's on my card. But yeah, I like the precision idea. You know, I think it's really important to do research into diabetes and manage diabetic medications. But you are chasing this, you know, really complicated endocrine system and getting these levels that fluctuate and all this stuff. But with a cornea, it's as close as you can get to, I'm trying to get this camera lens focused, you know, mm-hmm. and so you can get these really, really exact measurements of what's the exact curvature here. And you have a laser that's going to change it exactly this much. And it makes it's more satisfying for me, like this idea of it's really possible to achieve perfection of this.
It's like a self-contained. It's a self-contained system in a lot of ways that
yeah.
you can manipulate
yeah.
successfully.
Exactly. It's okay. And that's an appealing thing.
Well, I think that's all my brain can handle right now.
That was a lot.
That was a lot, but that was. I feel like there's so many puns here. It was really eye-opening.
Oh yeah, you're right. I hope that cleared things up.
All right. Well, we'll. We'll sign off for today, and we're looking forward to coming back.
I'm going to call a gin and tonic over here.
Oh, man, we'll have so many of those by the end. So next time, I think we're going to talk about a little, get more into the why eyes don't work and how glasses and contacts can help, because we just touched on that a little bit at the end there, but we'll definitely expand that.
I look forward to that a great deal.
Excellent. Well, there you have it. One last thing before we go. If you have a question for Dr. Hunter, or if you'd like to leave a helpful bit of feedback, you can email huntermd@huntervision.com. You can also get in touch by visiting facebook.com/huntervision. Thanks for listening.